Welcome to AgTech 360, where we take a 360-degree view into emerging agriculture technologies that matter, with our host, Adrian Percy.
So this is AgTech 360 with Adrian Percy, and I am delighted to welcome Jeff Rosichan from the Foundation for Food and Agricultural Research. And to get this right, first and foremost, is it FAR or is it FAR? Because I've heard both.
It's FAR. One of the Fs is silent. So we let people pick which one they would like to be the silent F.
Excellent. So thank you so much for joining us, Jeff. And what we want to talk to you today about is your work, but particularly around next generation crops, crops of the future. What might we see in our fields in 5, 10, 20 years' time? And what kind of adaptations do we need to see from our agricultural system with these new crops? But first of all, do you want to just say a little bit about yourself? I know you have a strong background in industry, but have done a whole host of things. So just tell us a little bit about your background.
So thanks for inviting me, first of all. It's a pleasure to be here. So my background prior to joining the Foundation for Food and Agriculture Research 5 years ago was 30 years in private industry working for big ag, small ag startups, and even a little stint in venture capital. So a very broad background, which I bring to my job now as a research funder.
Yeah, and you've seen all kinds of technologies and all types of crops in all types of places, right? Because I know that you're, you know, working globally, not just here in the US.
That's correct. And, you know, one of the really nice things about my job right now is I get to read a lot of really cutting edge research proposals that are really novel from all over the world. Because while the Foundation for Food and Agricultural Research was started in 2014 in the Farm Bill with an initial $200 million from Congress, and then we got another $185 million in the 2018 Farm Bill. The focus is to do novel cutting-edge research that fills gaps and needs and white spaces so that isn't being done by the other federal funding agencies. For every dollar that we invest in research, Congress wanted us to match their dollars at least 1-to-1. It's a way of leveraging the dollars because they saw in 2014 that the spending for public research was going down and we weren't really being competitive, particularly with Brazil and China, who are really trying to really develop their agricultural efforts. And they know that they have to fund research to be competitive. Private spending was increasing. And so that was really the focus of that 1-to-1 minimum match.
And is that match just coming from private sources or are there other sources that you're getting that matching
funding from? So it's any non-federal dollar. So it means it can't come from NIFA, it can't come from NSF, it can't come from USAID, but it could come from company, a foreign government, and we are able to actually directly fund non-US-based institutions as well. So we're able to really look globally at trying to fund the best research. But the other sort of key criteria is there needs to be some benefit to US agriculture. So you can look at what would be required to fund research to benefit small stakeholders in Africa, but as well, we have small farmers in the US. And so, you know, some of that research translates quite directly to some of our smallholder farmers in the US. And as well, you know, we look for research in different crops besides the traditional row crops in the US. So we try to focus our funding effort in many ways on some of the big challenges facing agriculture today, which is really diminished resources, how to get growers greater profits, and then also looking at, I'll say, sustainability in terms of soil health, water management, but also in terms of resilience. So as you start to think about impacts of climate change, both in the US and globally. And so we're able to think about funding research outside of the US where crops are being impacted by the kind of climate that we haven't yet seen in the US, but which you might predict we will have based on climate change. So it's kind of a fun and interesting.
Yeah. So such a broad research effort. And I know there are a number of different programs at FAR. And you, of course, are looking after the next generation crops, which sounds really, really exciting, very futuristic. What are some of the challenges that you see for growers here in the US? And how can new types of crops, new crops, or perhaps adaptations of current crops really help them?
So if you think about our current cropping system. In many ways, we've bred those crops to be super high yielding in non-competitive situations. As you start to think about soil health and greenhouse gas emissions and things like that, you might start to think about cover crops, for example, and how you might deploy and use cover crops to better manage your farm for sustainability. But again, because those row crops have been bred to be in non-competitive situations, you might think about maybe we need to change the way that we're doing our plant breeding and look at competition. And if you think back to agriculture, when the white Europeans came to the U.S., the indigenous people were actually co-cropping because they didn't have nitrogen fertilizer. Nitrogen fertilizer really changed the way that we farm. But on the other hand, as we've seen with the war in Ukraine, it's getting harder and harder to get that nitrogen at an affordable price. And for a lot of people in the developing world, the price of nitrogen and the seed is so high that there's not a way for them to actually, you know, grow crops the way that we grow crops in the U.S. But I also think in the face of climate change, our crops that we grow have not really been adapted for particularly rising temperatures. And then even you can think about these huge rainstorms that we've had and flooding. And so you might think about flooding tolerance. But there are crops out there that are maybe more resilient and resistant to climate change. So, for example, sorghum is a crop that comes to mind, which really hasn't received a lot of funding from private industry. It's really been more funded by the public sector. If you think about cowpea and other protein crops, common bean, mung bean, some of the legumes, we've got a really growing industry in the West when it comes to plant-based protein alternatives. Not that I believe that we are going to completely eliminate the need for animal agriculture, but I do think that consumers are asking us to maybe alter the ways that we do produce our food, the way that we do raise animals. And so that's going to increase the cost of animal-based meat potentially. And there are a lot of organizations or companies and startups that are looking at, can we synthetically produce meat or something that resembles what we'll call meat, and even milk and other dairy products. So I think given that we have to feed a growing global population, there's room for everyone at the table.
Sure. And we need more diversity in agriculture. I think few would argue against that. So you've talked about plant-based protein sources. You've talked about adaptation of perhaps some of our existing crops like corn and soybeans that need to be able to flourish in evolving conditions, shall we say. What about new types of crops? Are there any crops which aren't currently perhaps used extensively here in the United States that you see coming into fashion, as it were, with growers in the next 5 to 20 years?
If you think historically, it's been really difficult to start a new crop in the U.S. because in a way, you have to develop the methodology for growing that crop, but you also need to make sure that producers have a market for that crop. A really good example is hemp. There was a lot of buzz when hemp was finally legalized. However, everyone got really excited and was growing hemp for CBD. Before too long, there wasn't a place to sell that. As well, there were a lot of regulatory risks, which were really borne by the grower. So, you know, one of the things that we've started far, and I know USDA has really been also doing a lot in the hemp space, is really to look at, can we make hemp a profitable, sustainable crop for U.S. agriculture? One of the challenges is because we haven't done any research in hemp, we don't really have any U.S. adapted hemp for growing across broad parts of the U.S. So, you know, one of the things that our hemp consortium is really focusing on is the supply chain part of that. Day length sensitivity is a key feature. We've been growing Chinese hemp and European hemp and Canadian hemp. The places where those crops can be grown is somewhat limited. And as well, I learned recently that it's not a matter of when, but Chinese hemp will generally run hot, and which means that it has to be destroyed. And so the grower takes all the risk there.
Because of THC?
Because of the THC level. So hemp is defined as less than 0.1% THC. It is strictly regulated in that respect. You know, it's one of the things that we need to look at. Our consortia is really trying to focus on other uses for hemp. Particularly, hemp originally was grown really as an industrial fiber crop. And I think there's a lot of reasons why we can develop that industry. You know, one of the things that we're doing, we're working with NC State, which has got a really strong textiles department. And so we see that there's a lot of potential for hemp and even hemp Cotton fibers, another really good all-natural sort of a product, because if you think of consumers, and I, Adrian, I like to think of, so what are the consumer trends and future consumers? Because they're going to drive the demand that will make the ability for growers, U.S. growers, and even global growers to have new crops. They can't grow something if there's no market for it. And you need to have that market and the crop kind of co-developed at the same time so that people will try growing something that's new. And as well, you know, a lot of universities have great extension groups. And I think that's really important in terms of translating the research to the grower so that they really understand in their local conditions, under their management practices, how to grow a good crop.
So as you look at a crop like hemp or others that you've described, you're not just looking from the breeding perspective or from controlling key diseases or pests. You're really looking really holistically about developing the crop, but also the agronomic practices, the market, the processing, perhaps even, and the uses of that particular crop.
So having come from industry, it's important that people understand that people who grow crops have to make money to stay in business. And we need farmers to feed the world. And they do a great job of it. In fact, in some ways, they've been so successful that we take them for granted. One of the things at FAR, we use advisory councils as our secondary review panel. I was very deliberate when I put together the Next Generation Crops Advisory Council. I wanted an ag economist, because I wanted someone that really understands the whole value chain. And if you think about corn and soy and our other big crops in the U.S., there's very little waste. Almost every part of that crop gets used in some way. When you start a new crop, sometimes people will say, hey, I'll take that and use it. But as soon as someone figures out there's value for that, then that free thing is no longer free.
So you're really, as a leader at FAR, really convening as well, bringing industry together with academia, I'm assuming also with growers as well to a degree.
Yes. So, you know, one of the other things that we do at FAR, so we hold convening events where we bring in a very diverse group of stakeholders, academics, NGOs, growers, ranchers, whoever is the right group, to basically try to define, so what are the big research challenges? What are the big white spaces that we can fill? Because that's part of our mandate to be complementary but not competitive with the other funding agencies. But we also see our role as set up by Congress to really not just fund research, but to make sure that we're funding research that translates into the hands of the grower, the producer, that benefits U.S. agriculture. So the other thing that we do are form consortia. And so in the case I said, well, we formed a hemp consortia because it was new and there was just there's no shortage of research to be done to really make hemp, which I see as a potential broad acre crop in the U.S., to make it so that growers can grow it and make money. We've also, I was hired to be the director of the Crops of the Future Consortia. And that's really a public-private partnership with industry where the participants really drive the research that we fund. And we can do it through calls for proposals. We can do it through direct funds if they actually know who are the best researchers and that's who they'd like to fund. Or we can do prizes. And those are sometimes kind of fun. So we're doing at FAR a prize with the poultry industry, for example, not in my challenge area, but to look at non-destructive sexing of laying hen eggs. Because obviously in the laying hen industry, you don't need males. So we're looking for a way to basically do the sexing in the egg shells and then have another source where those eggs can go and be marketed. In the Crops of the Future Consortia, we try to really look for big issues, big challenges that are facing groups of industry that they can collectively de-risk. And then FAR matches all of their money, and we find things that are in the, what we call the pre-competitive space. So we were amongst the earlier funders of some plant protein work focusing on pea protein, of which none of the company participants actually sold peas. And then we're funding other technologies and tools to really help. So think about gene editing. How do you get gene editing into recalcitrant crops that aren't amenable to tissue culture? So that was the focus of another one of our projects, because we believe that gene editing holds tremendous potential to really accelerate the pace with which you can actually bring new traits into already really well-adapted varieties. Because in the past, what breeders would do is they'd make a wide cross with something that was, I'll call it wild and woolly. And then they would spend several cycles of backcrossing trying to clean that up. But when you're breaking chromosomes, you're really moving large chunks. And often you get some things that maybe you don't want that you can't get rid of. But with gene editing, it really gives you the opportunity because we know so much more about DNA sequence now, and we're able to identify the better sequences of the desirable traits that correlate with those desirable traits. And we can quickly move those in and stack them even using gene editing into already the best commercially available germplasm. And so that was something that, again, the crops of the future people were really behind and excited about. And even for companies that are maybe more consumer facing and don't necessarily want to develop products right now in that space, they need to be ready in case that there is broader consumer acceptance so that they can be competitive in the marketplace at that time.
So with all this amazing research that you're describing that you're involved in, I want you to get out your crystal ball and take a guess, an informed guess, because you're really at the forefront of seeing what's changing. I mean, how do you see agriculture changing over the next decades? What will be different in, say, 2030, 2050 from what we see today across the U.S.?
From the standpoint of the people that create the seeds, think about all of the wonderful advances that we've had in computers and machine learning and artificial intelligence. That's going to impact the way that we can accelerate the pace of breeding and new variety creation. And I think we are going to have to face climate change. And if you think about the way that we've traditionally done plant breeding, it's 8 to 10 years in order to get a new variety produced. Well, we're making all of the selections and the picking of those plants that are going to be the new varieties based on the current environment. And it's not the environment of the future. Using those predictive tools better is going to enable us to better create varieties that are going to be more climate resilient, better attuned to the new consumer demands. One of the areas that we focus on at FAR, so we are concerned about climate change. We're really concerned about both U.S. and global nutritional security. And the president just had a big event in Washington, D.C. about nutrition. There's a lot of opportunities to really look not just at our current crops, but also new crops that we can bring to market and grow in the U.S. and globally that are going to really provide people with better nutrition and health. And the role of what we eat on health is going to be increasingly more and more important. And I think it will start in the Western world, but it will translate into the developing world. And, you know, you and I, we can take a multivitamin every day. Well, that's not available in many parts of the world. So it's really about what you eat and how you get your nutrition and your micronutrients. And we know that climate change does affect the ability of a plant to take up those micronutrients out of the soil. So, you know, that's another, I think, target. And then the other thing is we're really looking at labor shortage, and we're looking at a growing, at least in the U.S., farmers are getting older and older, and people are maybe wanting to leave the farm. So I think I see a greater need for automation. And I think we might see that we're already seeing autonomous driving vehicles. Think of the advances that have been made in the medical world in terms of the way we can visualize things, and also the way surgery is done now using computers and less invasive technology. Well, those kind of techniques are going to translate into things that we can do in agriculture. So we're already seeing a better ability to do picking, pruning, spraying from drones. In the U.S., most large acre farmers, their farms are not all like right here in one spot. And so they have to send people out to do scouting. They have to send people out to irrigate. They have to send people out to do many things. And we're really looking at a shortage. And I think COVID kind of exacerbated that situation. So engineering, computers, robotics are going to drive the future of agriculture. And I'm thinking, gee, you know, when I look at like my children and my grandchildren, they love playing video games. So maybe farming is going to become more of a video gaming experience, and the young people will stay on the farm.
Absolutely. When I was in Brazil, I remember very clearly a farmer telling me that his son wants to farm with his thumbs, literally, if he's playing on his Xbox. So, and that will come. And so what I'm hearing from what you said is if I'm driving perhaps across the Midwest, maybe in my hover car or my electronic car in 2050, I'm still going to see maybe corn and soybeans. They're going to be more adapted to the climate at that time, but I'm also going to see perhaps hemp or plant-based protein, cowpeas, whatever they may be. And I'm going to see a lot of robotics being used to actually farm those as opposed maybe to humans actually doing some of this work themselves.
And, you know, robots, you can also think, allow the possibility to reduce the footprint and also the energy usage of. So they could be smaller, they could be solar.
And working continuously.
And working continuously, but also together. So one of the big challenges is we need better rural broadband because something has to run all this stuff.
Swarming robots. That's a great point to end on. Jeff, thank you so much. It's been great to talk to you.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
AgTech 360 is a product of North Carolina State University, the Center of Excellence for Regulatory Science in Agriculture, or CERSA, the North Carolina Plant Sciences Initiative, and the Southern IPM Center. This episode was produced by Kayla Pack-Watson with host Adrian Percy. With AgTech 360, we take a 360-degree view into emerging agriculture technologies that matter. Thanks for listening.